Hi, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's September 2025, and you are listening to episode 463, which is a conversation about whether the Bible teaches that pastors and church government are biblical. On this episode, I'm joined by Reverend Matthew M. Kennedy, who is the rector, aka senior pastor, of the Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York. He is also canon for preaching in the Anglican Diocese of the Living Word. Matt has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called, Are Pastors and Church Government Biblical? Authority and the Church in the New Testament Era and Beyond. And you can read it for free without a paywall on our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. Matt, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
As I noted, today we're talking about the whole issue of church government, about ecclesiology, and specifically if having pastors and church government is even biblical. And so we're excited to dive into this topic because I noticed that whenever we have some questions about this on our YouTube channel, we get some very ardent folks talking about why pastors, the pastoral office is unbiblical. So I wanted first to ask Matt just about different forms of church government, specifically ones that don't have more of maybe a hierarchical form of government. So can you walk our listeners through how, first of all, a congregational form of church government works and how it's different than something more structured or, as I was mentioning, hierarchical forms of government like Presbyterians, Lutherans, your Anglican, Roman Catholic, or Eastern Orthodox?
Sure. For congregationalists, and there's a variety of them, but in general, the congregation itself is the locus of authority. You don't have external in any other. Anglicans have bishops. Presbyterians have the session. I think it's called. There's a number of different extra congregational centers of authority for other non-congregationalist denominations. But for a congregationalist, it is the congregation that is the center of any kind of authority there is in the church. They might be loosely associated with other congregationalist congregations. So I think the Southern Baptist Convention, you might say, is in some sense a congregationalist organization, although there is some structure and you can be kicked out of the convention. But the convention doesn't oversee a parish. A congregation. The convention doesn't have any authority in individual.
Yes, they're all individual churches belonging to an overall association.
It's kind of a voluntary association, yeah. And most congregationalists will argue that that's how the church was originally organized in the first century by the apostles, and deviating from that has caused all kinds of problems through church history.
So, what are some reasons that those who hold to the congregationalist model would offer for rejecting church authority beyond the local congregation?
Well, there's practical reasons and there are some biblical reasons. I'll start with the practical ones first. And I mean, I think every Orthodox congregationalist would say the practical ones are secondary, but I'll start with those. What happens if you're involved in a very hierarchical form of church government, like say the Episcopal Church or the Roman Catholic Church, when the hierarchy goes bad? What happens when your bishops apostatize or just become corrupt? That can do great harm. And I speak from experience on this. That can do great harm to the congregations under their charge. So practically speaking, their argument would be it's safer for a congregation not to be tied to an organizational structure that could sink sink the whole thing. Better to be independent, so that if the congregation down the street or down 2 or 3 miles away goes bad, or the bishop goes bad, or another congregation goes bad, it doesn't have any effect on your particular congregation. And that way, it's kind of an organic model. That's the practical, one of the main practical considerations they have. Biblically, though, they would argue that while the church is every Orthodox congregation is bound together spiritually by faith in Jesus Christ. I mean, I think most biblically faithful Congregationalists I know would accept the Reformation notion of the three marks of the church being right, the right preaching, the truthful preaching of the gospel and the scriptures, the right use of the sacraments or ordinances, I think they would probably call them, and church discipline as the marks of a church. And if any church has those marks, it's a church. They would recognize that, and they would recognize the overarching spiritual union from congregation to congregation in Christ. But they would reject the notion that there needs to be anything beyond that, or that the apostles ever envisioned anything beyond that. The apostles, they would argue, once they died, left no edifice to replace them. So for example, the Roman Catholic Church argues that the office of Peter's office continued after Peter died. That there was another who took his place. The Congregationalists would say no. Anglicans don't argue that. Presbyterians don't argue that. Other denominations that accept extra congregational authority don't argue that particular thing, but we would argue that the apostles envisioned a continuing extra congregational structure after their departure. But again, the Congregationalist doesn't see that in the scriptures, and they see no need for it, because they would argue, and I agree with them on this, that the apostles still rule the church through their writings, the New Testament. The New Testament documents are the overarching ruler of the church, and like I said, I would agree with that, and I wouldn't agree with the corollary to that, which is therefore we don't need any other extra church office or extra church office or structure beyond that.
You open up your article talking about some circumstances that caused you at one point as a minister to have a congregation that was independent from another church body. So what was your experience with congregational independence?
Yes, we were part of the Episcopal Church in 2003 when the Episcopal Church agreed or consented to the consecration of Gene Robinson, who is a man who is a homosexual man living in a homosexual relationship with another man. And that caused, and we talked about this before, but that caused years and years of turmoil in the Episcopal Church that still continues. And a number of congregations within the Episcopal Church decided we can't continue in this denomination and left the church. And in doing so, you know, lost property, lost assets, lost lots of things, but also lost something that's very important to Anglicans, which is Episcopal or the oversight of a bishop, Episcopal oversight or the oversight of a bishop. We didn't have that once we left, and the Anglican provinces of the global South stepped up to offer their Episcopal oversight for many of our congregations, mine included. So for about 2 years, we were under the Episcopal oversight of the Church of Kenya, but Kenya is thousands of miles away and over the sea. So the oversight wasn't really, there wasn't much overseeing. So we functionally existed for about 2 years without a bishop, without any kind of oversight. So we were an independent congregation. And to tell you the truth, during that time, the practical argument made by Congregationalists began to make a lot of sense to me, because our bishop had done a lot of harm to our church. when the overarching hierarchy of the Episcopal Church became corrupt and apostate, we lost everything because of it. And I thought, well, wouldn't we have been better off if we had not had a bishop, if we had not had a diocesan structure over us that could take our property away? That made me, you know, question some of our polity for good 2 years. But I also recognized during that time, you know, there are reasons for practical reasons for extra congregational authority that come into play. One, I had no oversight during that time. I had fellow pastors who I could call and talk to, but I didn't really have a pastor. And that's what a bishop in the Anglican realm is supposed to be, a pastor to pastor. So I didn't have a pastor. I didn't have anyone kind of looking over what I'm doing and saying, hey, that's great. Or, hey, maybe you should think about doing something else in this position. And also, you know, I realize if something were to happen in a Good Shepherd, that's my parish, and there was some kind of subversion or division in the church, we were kind of on our own. I would have no one to appeal to beyond myself. You know, if the vestry, which is our governing body, decided to throw me out, there was no court of appeals really during that time. So I realized, on the one hand, it's attractive to have independence from structure. On the other hand, it can be dangerous too. So the practical argument really it cancels out. There's dangers on both sides. There's dangers in independence. There's dangers on the hierarchy. So the real question comes down to what does the Bible say?
What do we have coming up on the Postmodern Realities podcast on our schedule for the month of October? Well, we're going to start out with some literary apologetics. There is an American Southern writer that might be lesser known, but very important to know about his work and to read it. So we have a literary apologetics article coming up on the work of Walker Percy. And of course, in October, we have a month full of various different topics that deal with the occult, which is kind of a big thing in October. It seems like a lot of people in America at least want to talk about those things for some reason. I guess Halloween, it's kind of a good time to be talking about these topics that people are thinking about as they get ready to celebrate Halloween as a culture. And the first thing that's up is the Conjuring series, which is a series of 4 films that have been in theaters over the years. The one that is in the theaters now is the latest installment out of 10 films, and it deals with the work of real life paranormal investigators, and it's been going on, this film series. We're going to talk about The Conjuring. Then we have Lindsay Medinwalt joining us twice in October to talk about psychics and then to talk about mediums. And then we have an updated article on satanic ritual abuse with our Satanist expert, apologist John Ferrer. And SRA is a big topic. In fact, it's one of our most popular articles on our website that was published more than 34 years ago. So we are very much ready for an update, and John Ferrer is going to give us insights into satanic ritual abuse, where it is today, that particular topic. And so please make sure that you have bookmarked our podcast, that you download the episodes, and we appreciate you doing all the things, partnering with us, and that is getting the word out, subscribing, liking, making a comment, a review on Apple Podcasts, and we are just so thankful for your partnership, and we really want this podcast to grow because we think that many people who are Christians would like to listen in and be equipped on how they can answer these particular topics from a biblical Christian point of view. So now back to my conversation with Matt Kennedy about pastors and church government.
Well, now I want you to address the views of Christians who are in the house church movement. They would argue that the New Testament teaches, you know, mutual edification, the priesthood of all believers, 1 Peter, and that spiritual maturity is cultivated much more effectively through, you know, small groups and group discipleship. And therefore, the formal office of a pastor is unnecessary. Each one of the, they do have like informal leaders, but each one of those men can function as a pastor on any given Sunday and give a sermon. So they argue that there's no such thing as the office of pastor in the New Testament if you look at the early church. So how would you respond to that?
So again, I would say the question isn't necessarily one of pragmatics. I would definitely agree that a lot of growth and maturity is gained in small groups and in the fellowship among believers. The priesthood of the believers is something that Peter talks about in his first epistle that we as Protestants hold to be absolutely true. We all offer Christ a sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving, and offer our bodies as living sacrifices to Him. There's a priest to Christ. There's a priesthood of believers. That's absolutely true. And the church edifies, members of the church edify one another. And so the question isn't really whether all of that takes place. It does. And the question really isn't, can it take place without a pastor? I don't see why it couldn't with the Holy Spirit present. The question is, again, what the scriptures say. Has Christ, through his apostles, established the office of pastor, as we call it? And I think the biblical evidence is absolutely clear on that. And I think that it's undeniable that he has. You can start with 1 Timothy chapter 3. Where Paul gives instructions for the appointment of overseers and deacons, and he gives qualifications that Timothy is supposed to look for before laying hands on a person, a man to be an elder. Oh, I'm sorry, an overseer in that case, for a congregation. And then in Paul's letter to Titus, who's on Crete, he gives very similar instructions for identifying, making sure they're qualified men to be elders and laying hands on them. The interesting thing about the Titus passage is that Titus, there in Titus, Paul uses the term overseer and elder interchangeably. So it seems that in the first century and in the apostolic church, there were basically two established offices, that of elder and that of deacon. And the elder could be also called an overseer. Later in church history, the term overseer, which we call an English bishop, came to be a third office over the elder. But that's kind of maybe a side issue we can talk about later. In any case, there are two offices clearly established in the New Testament for the congregation, and that's the elder / overseer and the deacon. So the question whether is the elder / overseer the same thing as is that also a pastor? Well, in the same letter where Peter refers to all Christians as having a priesthood of believers, he also turns to address the elders, and he says, "Shepherd the flock that is among you." Shepherd the flock of God that's among you, is what he says. Now, the word for, he uses the verb form of the word shepherd, so you're shepherding. In its noun form, it's a Greek word that in Latin is translated as pastor. So that's where the word comes from. Peter there is most likely instructing the elders to whom he's writing to shepherd, to pastor their congregations well. And he says, when the chief shepherd, the chief pastor appears, you'll have a crown of unfading unfading glory. So the term for that we our term pastor goes back to that, and it seems there to be associated with the office of elder. If you turn to Ephesians chapter 4, there Paul explicitly describes. Well, he says he's talking about various offices in the church, and for one office he says a shepherd slash teacher, and there it is the noun form. It's not talking about function. It's talking about noun. There's a pastor slash teacher office. And almost certainly he's talking about the office of presbyter or elder. So therefore he's calling them pastors. So the term pastor, the use of that title is I think incontrovertibly related to the role of the elder slash overseer in a congregation. I guess another question might be, and maybe you'll ask it later, but I'm not sure whether you want to ask this or whether you want me to dive into it yet or not, but whether or not the apostles assumed that these elders slash overseers slash pastors would have authority in a congregation, or whether they were just there for, I don't know, administration of some kind.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be good for you to talk about who has spiritual authority over a congregation, because that is kind of what is being done in more hierarchical forms of church government. And also, what specific passages does it talk about Christians submitting to this kind of church leadership? I mean, you talked about pastors. There are passages that talk about pastors overseeing congregations, but what about the Christians themselves? You did talk about your experience with corrupt church leadership, and I want to ask you a little bit more about that later, but where are Christians supposed to have, you know, submission to that leadership? And of course, you know, just talking about where spiritual authority lies for the local congregation.
Sure. Those are great questions. Let me go ahead and answer the question of whether the pastor slash elder has authority, and then I'll come back to what kind of authority, what does that look like? Because it can be abused, as we all know. If you've been a Christian for any length of time, you know that pastors can abuse their authority. So while I'm showing, I believe I can conclusively show that pastors have authority in the congregation, that doesn't mean they have authority for all things. It's authority under Christ, not just over people. So in the same passage as I was mentioning in 1 Peter, where Peter addresses the elders and he refers to their job as the job of pastoring, their task as the task of pastoring, he goes on to speak directly to the younger people in the congregations, and he says, he's writing to several congregations, not just one. And he says to them, be subject to the elders. Now that's passages undergone a lot of debate, because the Greek word for elder, which is presbyteros, can be used for just an older person. So Peter, some say, is just telling the young people to be respectful toward the older people. But I think I just mentioned the context of that command. I think the context rules out that possibility, because after describing the task of the elder as that of a shepherd, he adds that those elders who do well will receive an unfading crown of glory when the chief shepherd appears. And I don't think there that Peter is just saying, you know, all old men hold analogous authority to the chief old man. I think he's really talking about an office in the church that's analogous to that of Christ over the whole church. And so that to that office, he's saying, hey, you young people who might be prone to rebellion, be subject to your presbyteros, presbyteroi, be subject to them and not and not rebellious. There's other passages too, in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 17. The author of the Hebrews, of the book of Hebrews, says, "Obey your leaders and submit to them, for they are keeping watch over your souls." He doesn't use the word elder there, but there is clearly a person or persons who are over the congregation, to whom the other people in the congregation must submit, he says. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, Paul writes, respect those who labor among you and who are over you in the Lord, and admonish you and esteem them very highly in love because of their work. He doesn't, again, use the word overseer, but he does use a very close, something very close to it. Respect those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord. That's just a way of describing an overseer or an elder. And then finally in 1 Timothy chapter 5, I think this is probably the clearest one, chapter 5, verse 17, Paul describes the elder as having authority or rule. He says, "Let the elder," that's presbyteros there, "let the elders who rule be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in preaching and teaching." So there's the connection there of the presbyteros with the notion of ruling in a congregation. So I just don't think I think the argument that the within a congregation there's no hierarchy at all, that it's just a flat system, doesn't hold up to biblical scrutiny.
So, you know, we're talking about biblical reasons for these things, and I just want you to kind of give us your ideas of why you think some Christians reject authority in the church. Like, for example, if all of these things are very clearly taught in the Word, why do you think Christians would reject any kind of spiritual authority over them? After all, I think a lot of Christians think that their relationship with Christ is personal. It's not really the business of the church, and especially as it has to do with things like church discipline. I know that not all denominations practice church discipline. And so there would be Christians who would say, first of all, my marriage is nobody's business but my own, my spouse and myself. It doesn't have anything to do with the church or my parenting or whatever it is, my spiritual walk. It's my spiritual walk. It's personal. So how would you address those who would reject any kind of authority from the church in their lives?
I guess I would ask, you say your relationship is with Jesus. I can show you in Matthew chapter 18 where Jesus has, in fact, left a pattern for congregations to follow to discipline erring members. So is your relationship with Jesus something that is extra biblical? Is it beyond or against or contrary to what Jesus says in the scriptures? And if so, I would say you probably are not relating to the real Jesus, because the real Jesus is who has been revealed to us in the scriptures of the New Testament, and he has very clearly indicated that we as Christians are to be within congregations where we can be held accountable, and our lives can be held up for scrutiny. And it's absolutely true that every Christian has a deep, intimate personal bond with Jesus. Absolutely true. But that does not preclude the wider corporate nature of our relationship with him. He incorporates us into a body with other believers. And so we're not just, our Christian life is not just a matter of us relating to Jesus in the scriptures, but us relating to Jesus and his people, his flock. We are brought into a corporate thing, not just an individual thing. I think probably that's a lot of, I think Americans tend to be very individualistic, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it can be a bad thing if it's applied in such a way that it subverts what the scriptures tell us about our union with Christ and our communion with each other. I also think, you know, probably that the pastoral office has been abused. There have been really bad pastors. We all know this, who have abused parishioners physically, sexually, who have abused their congregations by lording it over their congregations, taking authority they don't necessarily have. I mentioned a minute ago that pastors are under Christ, and that means that their lives and their personal lives and their life, public life as pastors, have to be under his rule, under his lordship. And if a pastor commands or says or tells you to do something that has nothing to do with the scriptures, then you have at that point, that pastor has lost his authority. He's obligated to only exercise his authority under the scriptures and under the lordship of Christ.
So, as you noted, Christians that hold to the congregationalist view of church government, they'll accept the local authority of the pastor, but they would reject any kind of wider extra congregational authority. So they would just want to function just within the church as an independent congregation. So why do you think that the New Testament teaches that there is oversight over local congregations beyond just themselves, that the church is not supposed to be in just many, many independent congregations, but that they're joined together?
Yeah, first thing I would point to is the interdependency of the various congregations you see in the New Testament. Take Peter's letter again, First Peter, that he writes. He writes to churches, congregations in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. And he assumes that his instructions in the letter that he writes are going to be applicable to all of those congregations, and that they're going to carry authority within each of them. He writes to them as a corporate body, even though they're individual congregations. You see the same kind of thing with Paul's letter to the Galatian congregations. His letter to the Galatians isn't just to one church; it's to a number of different churches in the region of Galatia. You see the same thing with the letters that Jesus dictates to John to give to the seven churches in Turkey and in the modern day Turkey in Revelation. There's a sense that all the local congregations were not considered independent entities, loosely confederated, but that they were bound together to one another. You also see this with the collection that Paul takes from the churches in Europe and in Turkey for the Jerusalem church. There's a sense of union, of belonging to a body and to a corporate structure that's beyond the congregation. And so the churches in Macedonia need to give, as do the churches in Achaia need to give for the welfare of the church in Jerusalem, because we're all one. So that's the first plank, just to notice here the interdependence, the sense of unity and union between congregations that you see in the letters that the apostles write, in the book of Acts you see it too. There's that overarching kind of structure there. But then beyond that, there are several examples where we see people who are not apostles exercising authority over more than one congregation. One of the first places you see that is with the apostle. I'm sorry, I said he's not an apostle. James the Elder, who is the half brother of Jesus. He seems to be the overseer of the church in Jerusalem. If you go to Acts chapter 15 and read the account of the council that takes place there, they're debating the question of how to incorporate the Gentiles into the church. Do they have to be circumcised in order to be justified? Do they have to be take on the dietary laws of the old covenant? And Peter and Paul are there that council, and so are all the presbyters of all the churches in Jerusalem and Judea. And there are Acts 20 later on tells us there's thousands of Christians in Jerusalem and Judea So we can assume there are more than one congregation. So you have the presbyters there at this council, you have the apostles there at this council, you have James there at this council to discuss this question. And the Peter and Paul both stand up and argue that the Gentiles should be received on the basis of faith alone, and that God has obviously, Christ has obviously received them because they're bearing the same marks, the same gifts that Jews do when they receive the gospel, or did when they received the gospel in the book of Acts, the Pentecostal moment. So that argument goes on, but in the end, it's James who makes the judgment. And he says in Acts chapter 15, therefore my judgment is that we should not trouble those of the Gentiles who turn to God, but should write to them to abstain from things polluted by idols. And he goes on and lists a number of things they need to do. And that settles it. And the council writes a letter that is in keeping with James's judgment, and they send it off to the various churches of the Roman world to settle the question. So you have here a council that's kind of overseen by James, and even the apostles seem to be deferential toward his authority. You see the same thing later when Paul comes to Jerusalem to give the great gifts that I was talking about earlier from the churches in Europe and Turkey to the Jerusalem churches. He comes to bring it to the people in Jerusalem, or the church in Jerusalem. And the church in Jerusalem is very suspicious about Paul because they've heard rumors that he's telling Jews that they should throw off their customs. And he hasn't been saying that, but James says, hey, just so we can assure the people that that's not what you're doing, you know, why don't you go and help these guys we have in this church pay the price for the sacrifices at the end of their Nazirite vow, which is probably what it was. And he does. Paul acquiesces to James's instructions. He recognizes James's authority in Jerusalem. And James has this kind of, we would call, say in Anglican, I would call it episcopal authority over the presbyters who are over the congregations in Jerusalem. So that's one example of, I think, an extra congregational authority being exercised by someone who isn't an apostle in the early church. A second example might be Titus. Paul leaves Titus on the island of Crete to appoint and oversee elders for various congregations. And he gives him, I mentioned this earlier, he gives him qualifications for the elders. And he also tells him, you know, you need to be ready to rebuke. Not only do your elders need to be able to to rebuke people who are teaching error, but you as my representative there, Titus, you need to be willing to silence the people who are teaching for shameful gain, things they ought not to teach. So Titus has oversight over elders who have oversight over congregations, and he has authority to rebuke people within those congregations who are leading people away or astray. So I think that's another very clear indication that there's extra congregational authority within the apostolic church. And that seems to continue after the apostolic era. The apostolic fathers is the name we give to those patristic writers who wrote during the first century, as in the case of Clement of Rome, or just at the turn of the century, like Ignatius of Antioch. You read their writings, and there again you see evidence that the church was organized in such a way that it wasn't, there weren't independent congregations. The epistle that Clement writes to the church, Clement is in Rome. He's a you might call him an elder / overseer in Rome. He and his a group of elders seem to have authority over all the churches there in Rome, and their authority is such that the church in Corinth, which is still having problems. The Corinthian church has always had problems. But they apparently have written to Clement and his fellow elders for help, because there's been a rebellion in the Corinthian church. The elders have been overthrown, and so the whole letter of Clement and his fellow elders to Corinth is telling them what they should do, how they should handle the problem. It's not Clement isn't issuing orders, but he is issuing, you know, older brother advice, kind of thing. He's not acting like a later day pope, but he is acting like someone who recognizes the church is bound together, and it's under authority, and there's no such thing as an independent congregation. It's definitely true for the churches in the city of Rome itself, that this group of elders had authority over the congregations there. Ignatius of Antioch, I mean, he's a bishop in Antioch, and I've written about him for Sierra. He is arrested and sent to Rome for trial and ultimately for martyrdom. And on the way, he writes seven letters to various churches on the way. And if you read the letters, he presumes to have the authority to advise them, give them counsel, tell them what to do, which is interesting. That's not consistent with a Congregationalist view of independence. But in his letter to the Philadelphians, Philadelphia, you might remember, is one of the churches that Jesus speaks to in Revelation. He writes this: give heed to the bishop and to the presbytery and deacons. You see, there are three. By this time, it's early second century. You already have the office of overseer, which is bishop, separated from the office of presbyter or elder. So you have a threefold office. Give heed to the office bishop and to the presbytery and deacons. Now, some suspected me of having spoken thus as knowing beforehand the divisions caused by some among you, but he is my witness, for whose sake I'm in bonds, and I got no intelligence from any man, but the Spirit proclaimed these words: do nothing without the bishop. Keep your bodies as temples of God. So most likely there's more than one congregation there in Philadelphia, and Ignatius is urging all of them to do nothing without the bishop. So again, I'm not arguing here for episcopal governance, but I am arguing that it's pretty clear that there is extra congregational governance that exists very early after the apostolic age, and that suggests that it just was a continuation of what was going on during the lifetimes of the apostles and with their approval and endorsement.
And not too long after that, I mean, in terms of the scope of human history, when you talk about several hundred years, the church, before there was, you know, East and West, the church had ecumenical councils in which they were dealing with theological matters, which they specifically called and invited all the churches to. So we do know that was going on in the church at the time. And some of the heresies in which they were addressing are heresies that have popped up even today, for example, in the Jehovah's Witnesses and their view of Christ.
Yeah, absolutely. There were councils of bishops that met to deal with false teachers and false teachings. I mean, the most famous one, because the result of it is repeated over and over again in churches every Sunday morning, is the Nicene Council. And the decisions of these ecumenical councils were considered to be authoritative for all the churches, every congregation. Now, our Congregationalist brothers and sisters will say that's a development that was in contradiction to what the apostles intended, but there was no evidence, there's no indication in the first, second, third, fourth, fifth centuries that anyone thought that until the Congregationalists came along. So it does seem like a kind of a natural outflow from what you have in the New Testament, where where churches are responsible to one another, accountable to one another, where there are appointed leaders who oversee not just one congregation, but many congregations.
So what are some, I want to get to some practical matters. What are some practical benefits for you, because you're an Anglican, in having a bishop who oversees you and for your congregation as well, or including other forms of church government? I'm in a denomination that has presbyteries, but there's other denominations and traditions that have synods. And so what are some of the practical benefits of having that larger church governance above a single congregation?
There are so many, it's hard to name. I mentioned some a minute ago, the in the Episcopal form of government anyway, you have a pastor. I as a pastor have someone who I can look to for counsel. I can look to for guidance, who will correct me if necessary. And if he's a godly man, that's a great thing. You want that as a pastor. You don't want to be out there by yourself as a lone ranger. But also, there's just the support that pastors need within a congregation. You know, what if there's a division in the church? What do you do if there is a false teaching spreading in your congregation that captures the minds and hearts of the majority? Well, in a congregational system, that's it. You're gone. There's a church split and it's done. In an Episcopal system or a Presbyterian system or in a Methodist system, that's not it. The extra congregational authority comes in and puts an end to it. And so that's a great help, right? If you have an abusive pastor in a congregationalist congregation, either in a real physical or sexual way, or just in a dictatorial way, there's really no recourse. What are you going to do? You just basically have to leave that congregation and go somewhere else. Unless it's the sexual stuff is legal, you can bring in some legal authorities. But if the pastor isn't doing anything illegal, you just got to hope that the board of elders or the other, whatever other structure there is, will step in. But if they don't, you have no other recourse. Within a hierarchy, you have recourse. You can say, hey, the board of elders here has agreed with our pastor. We think he's wrong. They're circling the wagons. Can you come in and give us some help? And in the hierarchical system, there'll be some help. On a practical level too, it's nice to have policies to lean on. Sometimes, especially when it comes to weddings and baptisms and funerals, people want to do some some crazy things, and it's nice to say, "Hey, you know, the bishop won't allow us to do that." if you want to have a problem with that, you can go talk to the bishop. So that you're not the bad guy necessarily. Bishops are often willing to be the bad guy for your parishioners if they have to. So there's some nice appeal beyond yourself. In general, I think it's a good example for parishioners to see their pastor submitting. You know, if they're called to submit to the leadership of their pastor, well, does he submit to anybody? I think it's really good for them to see him having to humble himself as well. Like it's not just a one-way street. There is humility on the part of their pastor, giving himself up to be held accountable by people above and beyond him.
I'm in a denomination that is Presbyterian, and all of the pastors, their membership is not in the church. Their membership is in the presbytery that has ordained them. And I think that's a safeguard for, you know, we do have congregational votes at times, so they don't have a vote because that's not where their membership lies. It's with the other pastors in the presbytery. So that's just one safeguard in our form of government. But at the same time, I would say that there are Christians out there who are going to reject this office of both pastor and larger church authority because they themselves have experienced church hurt from ungodly pastors. You mentioned your own situation where there was a heresy by, you know, bishops at that level and church leadership, or maybe they've even experienced spiritual abuse from their church leadership or pastor. So how would you answer that person who would say, well, that's proof of why we should not have pastors or other governing church bodies?
I mean, I definitely think that the presence of abuse within the pastorate gives us all reason to lament and mourn the fact that we're flesh and we sin, and pastors have to be held accountable to that. At the same time, you know, the fact that some fathers are bad fathers doesn't mean that fatherhood doesn't exist and can't exist. The fact that some mothers have been terrible mothers doesn't mean that all mothers must be done away with. God established the family. He set up the system where there's a father and there's a mother, and together they bring forth children and they raise them. That's a God-ordained and established institution. And so even if some have abused it, you can't throw it over because it's of God. You've got to recognize that maybe you were just in a situation that was abusive, but the institution itself is good. And I would say the same thing with the institution of the church. That I think I've pretty conclusively shown that there are authorities in the congregation and over the congregation that God has established, Christ has established. And so if you have been hurt by those in authority, it's a terrible thing. But you can recognize also, I think, I hope, that abuse is anomalous. It's not what Christ intended, for one. And it's a broken, what you've experienced is a broken thing, but when the institution works as Christ intended, it's a beautiful thing. And I hope that you find a place, a church where it's working as Christ intended. You don't want to throw over something Christ instituted because of those who have corrupted it. You want to cleanse the corruption out and restore the institution.
So are there any safeguards that denominations might create to prevent, you know, abuse that we were just talking about or rogue pastors?
That was such a huge problem, a huge question when the ACNA, which is the denomination to which I belong, the Anglican Church in North America, was formed. The question was, how can we keep bishops from running ramshot over congregations? How, if they go bad, how can we safeguard congregations? And it sounds like the solution we came up with is a little bit like the one that you guys have in the Presbyterian world. We've said that bishops, although they have pastoral authority over congregations and priests, they don't own the property of the parish. So in the Episcopal Church, that's what ultimately was decided, is that the Episcopal Church owned parish property. So the commands of the bishop came with material consequences if there was disobedience. Here we decided, okay, we're gonna safeguard congregations by saying that they don't, if they ultimately don't agree with the position of the bishop, they can leave and remain intact. There needs to be some kind of safeguard, some kind of check and balance between Episcopal power or presbytery power or whatever your denomination is, and the congregation. The congregation has to have some kind of, I wouldn't say autonomy, but some kind of agency within the system. And every denomination is going to have to figure out a different way to do that. But without that agency, because in those checks and balances, because we're all fallen, bishops, pastors, people, we're all fallen, and we're all sinful. Without checks and balances to restrain overarching ambition and power hunger, there will be tyranny and there will be abuse. So you've got to find a way to check the power of those in authority, and to maintain their boundaries can be maintained.
Well, I think the question will come up in terms of ecclesiastical courts, which we do have in our denomination and the denomination I'm in, and people will say, well, do they ever, you know, rule in favor of the congregant? And I'm not going to get into the details, but recently there was a very prominent larger church, and by the other ministers in the presbytery, and this is public information, by the way, They suspended him from ministry due to harsh treatment of congregants over a period of years. And so, yes, there are those safeguards where those kinds of issues will be brought forward by congregants and listened to from the other pastors. And if it's determined that those allegations are true, then they will be acted upon. And so I just want to say that, you know, I think we always look at extreme cases and think it doesn't ever work for the person in the pew, but there are times and situations where it does work for the person in the pew, even with regards to a prominent minister or large congregation. So I will just give that as an example on something that I've seen in my communion. So on a much lighter note, what are the things that you really like about church life as you enter past the summer breaks and into the rhythms of the fall?
Yeah, I just got off vacation. I was in vacation in July, and I really miss, my passion is preaching. I love studying for sermons and writing them and delivering them. I love that most of all. But I also missed having fellowship. And I mean, it's weird. I'm an introvert. A lot of people don't realize this, but most pastors are introverts, and so Sunday morning is exhausting, because you've got a lot of people to talk to and things, the social interactions, which are costly for an introvert. But I always, and this is the case in this, after this vacation in particular, but it's always really the case, is that after, you know, 4 Sundays away, I miss my people. I really want to be around them. And I love having a family beyond my family, which is what my congregation is. So I think most pastors feel that way, even if they're shy and reclusive sometimes.
Well, thanks, Matt, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's great.
You've been listening to episode 463 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Matt Kennedy. He has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called, "Are Pastors and Church Government Biblical? Authority and the Church in the New Testament Era and Beyond." You can read this article for free at equip.org.
You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.